Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
Yeah, welcome back, everybody. Guest today, Aaron Rubicek. Aaron, please tell us where you are in the world and what you do for a living.
Yeah, so my name is Aaron Rubicek. I'm the founder and CEO of a brand called Ponto Footwear, based in San Diego, California, with about half the team also based out of New York. What Ponto is we are a circular platform business. We're focused on the opportunity of circularity, which I'm happy to explain what that is more in a second, but focused on the industry of footwear and apparel. So we started out as a direct-to-consumer brand, really looking to innovate how product is designed to be more fitting for a circular economy and sort of recyclability model. And since the inception of Ponto, have extended into a wholesale business, a private labeling business, where essentially, you know, there's all these massive organizations in the footwear and apparel world that are looking to both optimize their supply chains in light of geopolitical tensions, but also figuring out how to accomplish environmental and social good requirements that governments are putting in place across the world. And so a lot of companies have had a lot of headwinds, laid off a lot of sustainability departments, and also are just so big it's kind of been hard for them to understand the nuance of how to actually shift and navigate a lot of that. However, as being a younger, smaller, more agile startup navigating these headwinds, we feel like we've figured out a lot of the solutions, and B2B partners can work with us in a much more cost-effective but also pragmatic manner to ensure that we don't enter a period of like sort of greenwashing 2.0, and instead really like fulfilling what the founding vision of Ponto really was, which was to inspire resilience in people and planet. And so what that means is making environmental and social good practices actually mean driving better business. So more cost-effective nearshoring strategies, delivering better product to your consumers, better story to your consumers, versus just doing it from a place of fear, guilt, and thinking you have to do it. So yeah, it's grown a lot. The focus has expanded, pivoted like every good startup, but yep. Super, super happy to be here and appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. And I just want to ask, because, you know, it's not something that I've heard, you know, really mentioned in that capacity so much, is the idea of, you know, kind of like a circular, you know, model. So can you kind of explain more about what specifically is you mean when you mention circular?
Yeah, so most people don't actually know what circularity is, but I would define it's a sub-definition of sustainability that I think is much more meaningful, but also a lot more pragmatic when it comes to how we operate as a society in terms of how we consume products, et cetera. So essentially what the circular economy is it's the concept of making products out of things, both synthetic and biodegradable, that can ultimately be disassembled and recycled or biodegrade. And so synthetic materials go back into producing that very same product, and the biocomponents go to biodegrade back into the earth. And so the reason it's such an interesting topic is, I think for about the past decade, as sort of environmental social good business practice adoption has been something we talk about, there's a lot of businesses or a lot of people that argue that, like, well, environmentalism can't exist at the expense of commercial profitability and success. And instead, we need a model where those two things can happen in tandem if we actually want to implement this stuff and not just make it greenwashing, which is talking about sustainability, but not actually doing anything about it.
Right.
And so circularity, I personally believe, and many believe, to be the more adoptable and pragmatic way to actually make, like I said, fulfilling our vision of resilience in people and planet, but more resilient supply chains, more resilient product, and just doing better business, a concurrent outcome with doing better things for the planet. Actually, circularity was born in Japan when Japan was on feudal isolationist rule in 1600. They're one of the most major natural nutrient deficient countries or land masses in the world. And so when they cut themselves out from the world, they, out of necessity, created this sort of culture of circularity, which is, you know, the things that they use, they then use again and repurpose into things. And so it has a long history and heritage coming out of Japan, which is why that market is of extreme importance for Ponto and will be our first international launch point. But also why, when so many people go to Japan, they're just like, the Japanese are so clean, they're so ethical, they're so organized. And it's like, yes, this actually roots back hundreds of years and is where this all comes from. So
yeah, that's awesome. And I think it's really important. I mean, one, from a marketing standpoint, but also, you know, just from a, you're right. I mean, we can't go like take this huge step and force everyone to take these huge steps to be ultra sustainable at the expense of prices for consumers, at the expense of small businesses that already are, you know, struggling to compete against, you know, these massive established businesses. But I think from a, like a marketing standpoint, you know, the word sustainable is just thrown out there with no really clear definition. And when you see that attached to a brand that maybe even one that you like, you're not always really sure what that means. I mean, when I see that, I don't know what it means. I mean, does that mean like you're like what you make is sustainable? Like the business is sustainable? Like, I hope so for your sake. Is like, is it a business thing? Is it an environmental thing? You just don't know. I feel like it's just a blanket term that people throw out there and it's not always clear what it means. So more clear definitions with things like, you know, circularity, I think is kind of the way that people can position themselves so that and actually be transparent about what they're actually doing, not just saying we're in this good side here. So all the consumers know we're in the good side and we're sustainable. And it's like, whether you can't actually find any information about like how that's the case or any evidence to support it. So definitions like that and like really clear labeling with like, I know I mentioned off the pod, we've been doing a lot of CPG lately. That's another area where it's like, okay, you're gluten free, but you know, you only have to be 20 parts per milligram, or under to be considered that. And people are still get very sick when they have celiac and eat it. So these very clear definitions, I think are really, really important. I'm happy you got the chance to explain that because I think it's really important for consumers, but also people that may be getting into this space. It's important for them to know, to, you know, have a real meaningful kind of labeling and practices if they're trying to be sustainable. So
yeah, and I think I appreciate that. It's 100% correct. Like sustainability is a very diluted term at this point, and I'm firmly of the belief, as is our team, that circularity is sort of the opportunity to give sustainability meaning, value, and excitement again. Mm-hmm. However, with that comes the obligation to understand what is the sequence of actions, paths, foundation building actions to actually build a circular economy. And right. So an interesting sort of reference point for what circularity actually looks like is really one of the only industries that's ever successfully adopted circularity is the printing industry. And so when printing solutions digitized, I don't know if you remember ink cartridges, not many of us print much anymore outside at an office space or a FedEx location, but you'd buy that printing cartridge, you'd run out of ink, a little color would trigger in terms of like a phase change on the actual ink cartridge itself. And it came with a pre-packaged bag with a shipping label. You'd put the cartridge in there and you would ship it back and get a rebate that would then apply towards your next cartridge purchase.
That's very true. I forgot all about that. Yeah. I don't know why it never occurred to me. I was like, there's nothing else in the world that does this, but yeah.
This is textbook Casey stuff, but that's a successful model where you're financially incentivizing the purchase as well as the take back. And it creates a reoccurring revenue model that's very profitable for an end business. For the industry that we're focused on, as well as for other industries, there's sort of a series of steps that you need to accomplish to make circularity adoptable. And it starts with cutting off the usage of new, what we call virgin synthetic materials. So it's using recycled content for whatever it is you're making. It's electronics, footwear, et cetera, using as much recycled content as possible so that we're not putting net new plastics into the world. And then where possible and feasible, you're using the necessary biological components or from the earth that can biodegrade and go there on. And building, like, it starts with a set of design standards and it starts with building things out of the right materials so that ultimately it can be taken back and recycled. There's a lot of barriers that get into place in terms of the adhesives that you use when you construct products, actual materials you use. It's like take back and all that stuff is great, but like at the same time, the waste management system needs to be set up correctly with the right design standards, material standards, and material usage standards that also can commercially scale, because that's where things get very confusing for the end consumer too. As you'll see a lot of press around a lot of these new, like, exciting biomaterial innovations for leather alternatives, fabric alternatives, mm-hmm. But it dilutes and distorts, like, it could be 10 years away from how financially scalable that product is, being able to implement it into a huge behemoth company. So yeah, I could go on and on and on about this, but I think the key thing to ensure circularity does have meaning and is adopted is we understand sort of the sequence of actions that need to take place for your individual industry for that to occur, but then also educating the consumer about that so they can feel like a steward in that journey, really using their dollar as their vote to give this meaning again, if you will.
Right. Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. And I really appreciate your passion on this topic because I don't think it's something that's talked about. And I don't think most people really even understand or have even ever heard that term before, nonetheless, like, understand what it means. So I think this is really important for people to hear and understand. Whether you're a business owner trying to be sustainable in your business or a consumer who wants to support, vote with your dollar, as you say. So I think that's really important. I appreciate it. So what kind of challenges does that kind of pose for you going down and kind of working through this model and wanting to be very sustainable and being circular? What kind of challenges does that pose for you in your product development and kind of like your logistics about how you get products out and how you manufacture your products?
Yeah, I think there's sort of what challenges did it pose in the past and there's sort of what challenges is it posing presently and then what does it pose in the future? I think when we first started out, we started out, you know, I started the business in 2018, but we launched in 2020, but we were building samples and products and doing all that before then.
Gotcha.
We were a really small brand. And with that comes just like manufacturer willingness to really dive in and work with the requests that you have as a new brand. Working with sustainable materials is historically a pain in the ass. It is expensive. It is difficult to source them. And when a factory partner or sourcing agent partner has other much larger business that already exists today, their willingness to work with a small brand that's extremely demanding just by virtue of being a sustainable partner, because we're looking under every nook and cranny, can create a lot of tension in terms of who's willing to work with you overseas. But luckily, both our team as well as the partners that we work with overseas have been really supportive of what we've done since then. I think there was sort of the initial hypothesis proving, which was sort of our like $1 to $1 million in revenue phase. And it was really just showing that there was a thesis here around designing product from the inside out versus the outside in of just style-based stuff, really like industrially designing product around consumer inconvenience and use case, as well as like needs to adopt a circular economy. And so I think that's kind of the point we're at now, where it's more challenges around driving scale with this problem. And so, yeah, when you're looking to implement the circular economy in general, as well as just a more agile business model for an inventory-intensive business, I think we're coming out of an era where people are really woken up a lot more to the realities of owning a direct-to-consumer-owned business, the cost that that imposes on you. Yeah, just the cost, the timing. It's not a very feasible business model, just relying on it solely given how expensive advertising has been, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, especially over the last year or two, I feel like we've been going to this more like omni-channel revenue diversification phase where brands are leaning more into wholesale as well as other opportunities. We certainly have, and figuring out how to actually make scalable consumer brands like profitable. And so I think where a lot of the challenges exist around that, the tariff code obviously has made that very difficult. The supply chain in China is just a lot more, not of the times from like a humanitarian perspective, but from like an innovation scalable capacity perspective. It's just like that's what the industry has been. So if you want to drive any level of scale, impact, and cost efficacy to date, it's predominantly been out of China. But now, I mean, individual categories have been driven so to such a point of like a pressure cooker in terms of they're not profitable because of how expensive the tariff code is, that there's not really a need to explore nearshoring solutions, whether it's in Central America, Mexico, just closer manufacturing facilities to the country that you're selling your products in. And when you do that, a lot of brands, I think, initially want to go work with factories and do everything in the localized supply chain. So sourcing leathers, foams, et cetera, everything. And let's just use like El Salvador as an example. They want sort of all these things that tend to be an ecosystem surrounding around a really robust factory environment. But what a lot of brands I know that have attempted nearshoring have found is like that localized supply chain doesn't entirely exist to the extent that you need it to, which both scale friction as well as just general, like, does this work for our business? And so I think one of the biggest challenges for a lot of businesses, especially in light of a lot of the headwinds I've mentioned, whether it's how you're generating revenue, how you're sourcing product, and ultimately driving the adoption of what matters here to us, the circular economy, viewing things very sequentially and incrementally, where it's like, let's just, I mean, a shoe alone can be composed of upwards of 120 components. It's quite a complex product to source, but like maybe it starts from sourcing bottoms or like the actual shoe bottom from where you currently are today and doing the more upper materials in a localized capacity in a nearshoring environment, because then you're not threatening scale with like your adoption and lean into like more of a nearshoring strategy. So I think, I'm both speaking to a lot of the issues we're facing as a business, but what I connect with a lot of other founders and brand owners about, which is just generally like in light of these shifts, what's realistic and possible? Because I mean, I think especially given just how we consume information, whether it's on LinkedIn or how we educate ourselves via like newsletters from the Gary V's of the world, et cetera, is like everyone thinks like the new shiny thing is the new perfect thing. Mm-hmm. And so like all these businesses that have been, us included, like leaning away from direct to consumer and leaning into wholesale and more distribution-like relationships, you're like, it's cash flow positive, it's going to be quick, it's going to be easy. It's like, no, wholesale shipping and operations is gnarly. Like it's a very difficult thing to do. And there's especially like packing lists and international operations. And so I think there's also, a lot of this stuff comes down to just when you find Like, there's a reason these business practices have historically existed in terms of mm-hmm. brand wholesale or how you manufacture and source. It's like, you really need to be cognizant of sort of where you're coming from and where you're going and putting a really incremental, well-sequenced strategy together, because otherwise you could just as quickly be putting yourself out of business by the newest form of shiny object syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really important for people to hear as well, which is, you know, I think as entrepreneurs, so many times we think of like these shifts that we want to make and pivots that we're trying to make as just like a one step is going to, like, everything needs to change on that front. It doesn't have to be that way. Like, sometimes you can do things incrementally, and like, just like you change things incrementally with your product strategy and your marketing, you test things out, you get feedback, like, to yourself and the things that don't matter to the consumer that's buying, but what matter to you and your bottom line as a business owner. You can test things with those types of things too. It doesn't always have to be consumer feedback. Sometimes it can be giving yourself feedback from, okay, like, I made this incremental change to one of the 100, you know, parts of my assembly that I used to source all from China. Now I'm doing two of them in Mexico or El Salvador. If it works out, maybe we move a little more, and we'll move a little more until, you know, it seems like, okay, maybe this is feasible altogether, but it takes time. And I think so many entrepreneurial spirited and minded people just can kind of think in like ultimatums and absolutes, where, because it's just like, decisions just need to be made. And if it's like, if you're making like 1% of a like overall decision, I think it'd be uncomfortable for a lot of people. So, but you know, I think that's a good perspective. I think it's a healthy perspective that people, I think, should take into account when they, you know, have decisions like that to make. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I love Japan. Japan really matters to us given we're a circularity business, but they also are a very like celebrated and successful culture when it comes to scaling innovation and mm-hmm. new business practices. And there's a philosophy in Japan called Kaizen, which is just sort of, it's metaphoric. It's kind of like, you know, one foot in front of the other every day, focusing on just never ending continual improvement. It's been adopted in more popular forms, like in B2B books, like the Toyota method, if you ever have heard of it. And like, literally when we were in Japan, we went to go visit a factory for a very famous Japanese knife supplier. And they literally had a part of the factory, an office that was called the Kaizen department. And it's like the internal consulting
group. That's awesome.
Evaluating like these little optimizations and changes they need to be able to keep up at the scale they want. And if you look at, I think the EV space is a really interesting space to look at like this, where you're seeing these like big swings over to EV that we did as a society. And there's challenges associated with that. I'm a huge believer in electric vehicles, but there's things to consider in terms of like EV vehicles are way more heavy. And so like infrastructure in society is like bridges, roads are not, I don't know the right terminology, but they're not constructed sufficiently to handle.
They're not ready.
Yeah, carrying capacity. And yeah. In addition to that, like batteries and like freezing with like more extreme temperatures. Like I know with what happened in the Midwest this year, there was like all sorts of charging stations and batteries that didn't work. Mm-hmm. And once again, like you've seen Toyota as like a champion of like the Kaizen business philosophy. Everyone's been like, they've been kind of quiet with regards to like electric vehicle adoption. It's like, well, they've been more sitting in the like chargeable plug-in hybrid space, as well as still being able to use gas to some extent. And I really think like a brand like Toyota has totally been sitting on the sidelines, just being like, that's totally the way we want to go, but like not wanting to run into all the cost hurdles of,
yeah, let's let everyone else make the mistakes. Correct. And then we'll come in with the best version of it, like we always do.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, I mean, I don't think it's an oversimplification, this concept of Kaizen, but it's something that's really important. And I think it get lost again if, when you're an entrepreneur in, you know, a venture project where there's 1,000 things every day, you can forget that like you need to take these steps to think about scalability, even though the last month you might only be really thinking about one project that's just like never ending series of like fires that you're putting out. It's still important to have that. And, you know, just think for like your 30 or 45 minutes of a day, like remember your Kaizen, remember your thing, or that thing that you know you need to take a step towards, even though it's not the most pertinent thing, it's still something you need to take a step towards every single day, 365 days a year. But it's important. It is. You know, it might sound simple, but there's a reason why Toyota has a Kaizen department, because it might be simple, but if you forget it, like, it's simple, but it's something that needs to be incessant and persistent every day. So it's definitely worth mentioning. It's something people should hear and continue to remember, I'd say, for sure.
Yeah, it's important for both mental health. So that you wake up and it's like, what are the 1 to 2 things I actually need to do today to move the ball forward? And mm-hmm. a good metaphor for it, I think, is just like compounding interest. It's like, if that 1% improvement every day takes place over 365 days, not to be so Warren Buffett, it's like, that's really good compounding interest.
It's a lot of performance. Oh, that's awesome, man. So let me ask you this. I'm curious. I know you mentioned the beginning that you kind of started from direct to consumer, which is obviously, as you know, pretty typical for any brands to start online or started kind of like during COVID. I know you said you kind of launched 2020 like you did. So what was your kind of path path from starting with that to doing wholesale? And then I think you might have said that, you know, your private labeling was the most recent venture that you've done. Can you kind of just walk me through, you know, how you ended up making the decisions to go like each one of those routes and how successful they've been?
Yeah, I think so. When we started, like I said, we originally were a direct-to-consumer brand. My background, I was at Google and YouTube for 5 years, sort of in that revolution of things. So yes, launching a business became much more accessible, as well as advertising was cheaper back then. Profitable acquisition happened was easier. So I think we came out of this period, I would say the later like end period of like direct-to-consumer being like the shiny object, everyone thinking like that's where the world, there were tons of venture money thrown at that space across Allbirds, Rothy's, Everlane, Outdoor Void, like there's a whole cohort of brands that came up from that chapter and really moved the world forward in a lot of ways that have sort of been a rising tide that's lifted ships like us. But we were one of the brands that just didn't, we didn't raise shit tons, pardon my French, of venture funding like a lot of those brands did. And so, I mean, we were literally launched on liquidated 401k money during the pandemic, as well as like liquidated savings that my founder had in a slight SBA loan, not PPP or like that stuff. It was just like a classic 7A loan.
Right.
And I went to Google still for 3 years while founding my business. Wow. So we're really like a more typically bootstrapped type of brand. I think we had a good brand story. Our brand identity, like, you know, we developed it and we learned to like give it like more sense and like really get clear on our why and how we represent that over the first couple of years. But I think, yeah, we just sort of had that natural wake up moment where it's just like, as most brands are, where it's like, you can't fund a brand or a company just on investor dollars. Like, I think we also came out of the Silicon Valley culture that celebrated raising venture capital like it was a huge sales win, like a huge enterprise level sales deal. And that leaned people away from like actually talking to their customers and like ensuring that you're delivering value, which I would say is like the typical culture of entrepreneurship. And I think the last couple of years has been waking up to the fact that like, well, raising venture money is actually just raising a big obligation that you have to then deliver on.
Essentially,
and, yeah, across a mix of the near-death moments and things that just naturally happen along the entrepreneurial trail, you're forced to get really real if you want to survive and have a business that can cash flow and sustain itself. And there's no better time for that than when the venture ecosystem has been relatively shut off for the last couple of years. And so I think it's forced us to think a lot more like a small business, which is really healthy. And I think it's, you know, speaks to like one of the philosophies I have in life, which is, I think it's like a Winston Churchill quote or something. It's like, never waste a good crisis. And so a lot of these changes have just been around getting real around what we need to do to actually have a viable business versus just endlessly raising investor capital to survive. So along that trail, yeah, wholesale is a natural evolution. I think it comes down to like, there are just people in the ecosystem of footwear that have distribution networks, relationships with wholesalers, et cetera, that can, if you have a really good product and a good story, can help you scale it quicker and just not make you have to learn everything. But also it also cuts really deep too. We're like, towards the end of last year, I was at a dinner with one of our board members and my co-founder. And I was just like, I'm really sick of talking to investors. I feel like that's all I've done for the last 5 years. Nothing against investors. They're great. But I was like, I just feel like I could be more thoughtfully putting this sort of salesmanship energy and passion to work. And I was like, I kind of want to just hit the road and sell shoes out of my car, like the greats did, or like anyone that made it did. And so
yeah,
a lot of support from my team and some of our investors. Yeah, I hit the road for 70 days at the beginning of the year.
That's awesome.
Like all this new product that my co-founder helped develop and like reimagine. And the whole goal was like, let's actually get out there and start talking to our customers and like understanding like, does this thing matter? And like, how do we make it viable? And that process of just getting out and like driving across the heartland, I did 17 states in 70 days and then went to Japan to launch the brand there. And
that's,
it's
so
like
cool.
The rate of optimization that happened for the business when I actually was living the business. It's not rocket science, but it kind of feels like that given how many hours are spent just sitting behind Instagram and Klaviyo and screens and Gmail, et cetera. And it's just like, nah, like get out there and talk to your customers. And like, it's the best way to hypothesis test and also like listen to what's real, possible and achievable. So yeah, still never-ending challenges, but yeah, the opportunities of that sequence of revenue streams, et cetera, all sort of unveiled themselves just kind of on this natural journey of how do we build a business that can sustain and scale.
Right. Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. And I feel like the omni-channel kind of approach is like really where I think a lot of business is going, like kind of across industries, because I think it was kind of two things in my experience. Was pre-COVID, there was like, you know, like you say, the big shiny thing was like e-commerce. That was like the big e-commerce boom, the big Shopify boom. And like, it's kind of odd that that happened the time that it did, because I feel like at that same time was right before COVID. And then when the pandemic did happen, I feel like people's reliance on wholesale and retail, people realize like, oh, that could all end in an instant. You know, so like, that's not a viable thing to only have business through wholesale. Like, no, we're never doing that again. So there was this kind of like that big e-commerce push was happening right as like people started to realize like, oh, my wholesale, all of my money that comes in could all be taken away if I just sell in Walmarts or just sell in Walmarts and Targets. Like it could all be gone tomorrow. Like who knows what's going to happen next. And then now it feels like, and tell me if you agree with this, it feels like people are starting to, you know, get back to having like, things are starting to pan out again. So I'm not saying people are wrong in thinking this, you know, people are starting to trust wholesalers and like retail business again, which is probably right. And I think coming out of the pandemic as well, it's so interesting that timeline, because people realize I don't have to leave my house. Like I can just shop online. I get everything I need right from my house and they'll deliver it. Amazon delivers in 2 days. Even if I have to wait a little longer, I don't care. You do it from my house, it's fine. And then we had COVID and everybody's like, I'm losing my mind. I can't sit in the house anymore. I want to shop. I want to talk to like the person at Macy's. I want to talk to the people at Target that work, like just to get some, you know, like person to person time. So it's been a really interesting, I would say, like, and I'm sure you know better than I do, you're running this brand during that exact time. You know, it's just been a really interesting kind of sequence of events with, you know, which types of channels are viable. And I think the ultimate take that I find to be most sustainable and successful in all the brands that come on the podcast and I do interviews with is this kind of like more variable omni-channel approach, like you're doing with, you still have your e-com brands, you're doing wholesale, you're doing private labeling. So at least if something happens again where like your wholesale goes down the toilet, at least you have these two other channels and you know how to nurture them and maybe, you know, bring people over from what you're doing before to nurture those back to, you know, the revenue goals that you used to have. So yeah, I'm just curious if you like, is that how kind of how like your experience was during that time, like pre-COVID, during and after? Because it's like, obviously it's like a tale of like three worlds in small business over like the past, you know, 6-7 years.
Yeah, totally. And I feel like every year it's just been like, oh, it's never been this bad before. And it's just like, well, yeah, I think a lot of this is just coming back to a classic strategy when it comes to risk and how you place it. It just comes to a diversification of revenue, diversification of cost, so that any individual change that is external and you experience, or that is internally initiated, has an incremental non-existential effect to your business. And so that's a very simplistic way to verbalize something like that. But I think everything you said is 100% true. It's when, and it applies from everything in terms of how you're generating revenue on the internet to how you're generating revenue in wholesale, but also how you source product in the supply chain. It's like, you should not be relying upon one country or one manufacturing facility or one channel or one product, because if that's the case, one thing changes in the form of behavior, it's existential, and overnight, like, it could be lights out. Yeah. And once again, it's easy to talk about an ideology. It's different in actual adoption and practice. But yeah, I think this is yet again, whether we're talking about circularity, whether we're talking about driving profitable business in a down, you know, venture environment, it's just like, at the end of the day, it comes down to just business planning and like just keeping your optionality there, where it's like, even if you start to nearshore, like, and that's what we help a lot of other brands do, it's, we need multiple factories because there's scale risk, too much geopolitical tension in the world. It feels like there's more now than ever. I think we just feel it and know it more than ever because shit like TikTok and Instagram and stuff like that.
It's so much more visible now. It's like, even stuff that's been going on for literally centuries in certain parts of the world.
We always have handrails. Like, so
yeah,
it's an
issue. Yeah, exactly.
So I think it's just basic, once again, investing 101 is diversify your portfolio.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly, yeah. There's one question I always like to ask everybody that comes on the pod. Obviously, you've been kind of a little pre-COVID with your development launched in 2020 and kind of going on to, you know, have these different channels that you sell through, right? So knowing everything you know now, everything you learn the easy way, you learn the hard way, going to Japan, all your experiences, like if you could go back to, you know, day one of starting the brand and give yourself one piece of advice, what do you think that piece of advice would be?
Hold on, I'm just trying to sit with it versus like just spewing something just to sound nice on a podcast.
No, I appreciate that. Actually,
I'm very like, I have like social anxiety, I'm a total people pleaser, things like that. And I think whenever you're an entrepreneur and you're jumping into something new, the only way to figure shit out is to break shit and like figure stuff out. Pardon my French, but it's like you have to fall on your face to like get back up. And I think in the early years, I exposed myself to way too much outside advice from different, all well-intentioned people giving me their time, willing to listen, willing to help, like willing to lend their heart. Like, so this is no discredit to them. It's more just a slight to my own learning journey. That was like, I almost got like, I would avoid doing the hard thing or like making the mistake on my own and try to relegate that off by seeking too much advice from other people. And it would both hold back my own learning journey as well as distort my own, like developing my own intuition when it comes to like making sound business advice going from being like an account manager at Google to whatever it means to be a CEO. Having a tribe of mentors is super important. And once again, this is no discredit to like the village of people that have given me their time, like so above and beyond what they should. But I think it's getting really clear on who your tribe of mentors are, kind of limiting that, I would say, to maybe like 5 people at most in terms of who you go to seek advice from. And like, what is that person a subject matter expert in that like they can help you accelerate through that learning on your own? I think in the first couple of years, I sought advice about everything from a lot of people because people are super accessible on the internet and people, I mean, there's just a lot of really friendly, good people out there who are very competent. And I think that just held back my own falling on my face and taking risks and just stuff that's pretty normal and natural and building your own business. And yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science, but yeah, that'd probably be my biggest.
No, it's fair enough. And it's good advice because in 2024, even in years past, I mean, the ability to have like fractional help in any very specific thing that you need done is basically infinite. I mean, you find somebody on Fiverr, you pay them $100, like, you know, maybe you get a decent job done, but it's not that important, whatever. But there is hundreds and hundreds of advisors and people, like you say, willing to help. And it sounds like did help you, but you know, you can only sustain that relationship and like pay those people and, you know, have that exist for so long before, like, you know, you try to learn from what they taught you and what they did for you to try to do it on your own. And even if you learn perfectly from the perfect advisor, you're still going to make your own mistakes doing it. And in the early stages, you might be right. It might be better maybe to like go through those things on your own and maybe like fall on your face, as you say, and make some of those mistakes on your own before you have an advisor come in. So, you know, maybe you can advise them on your specific business, like mistakes you've already made and things like that. So I think that's actually really proper advice, actually.
Yeah. And I don't think it, like now that I think about it more, like I don't think it just applies to advisors. I think it's just generally a sentiment of outsourcing things.
Yeah.
Like I think we came up and we're still in this phase of kind of like internet companies where it's like, I can sit on a beach in Tahiti, like completely unplugged and just watch the Shopify revenue like come in. And it's just profit city, baby. And it's just like, there's like this sort of like misnomer around like, we all wanted to become entrepreneurs. Becoming an entrepreneur became a lot more accessible. Yeah. And so there was like this mass culture of outsourcing where it's like, you could just solve all your problems through vendors and software.
And automation, automate everything.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Like, no, like you still have to understand how that part of the business operates for automation to work and make financial sense. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yeah, early on, and some of it might be a product of having still worked full time for a few years. And once again, sort of coming from that venture ecosystem where I think people felt like they could buy their success, which is like, that is never the case. It's all work ethic and luck. Like I just, the quote of like, the harder you work, the luckier you get. But yeah, I think it's, I would have outsourced less and like started the business off like, you know, we did the customer tickets in the earlier days and like that's why our customer experience went better. But like we should have been doing the shipping of the packaging. Like I should have been traveling in my car sooner, like selling directly to wholesale and like voice to the customer, voice to the operation and like ears to that stuff is so critical. So yeah, just less outsourcing for both advice, services, et cetera. Build from the outside.
No, I think that's great advice. And
inside out, rather.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I get that. And it's, again, you know, a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs and I think people listen to the pod to try to learn from other people's mistakes many times. And especially if somebody's looking to get into the space, maybe they come across the video, they see a little thumbnail of your product and your face and they say, this is exactly what I'm trying to do. Maybe they can learn a little bit from you about like, you know, things that you've done, that you've tried and take this advice and maybe not make all the mistakes that you made. So it's quite valuable, I think, for people to hear. And I really appreciate it. So I also just want to give you a quick opportunity, Aaron, before we hop off. I just want to give you an opportunity to plug your website, any socials you want people to know, anybody listen to the pod, they love you, they want to keep in touch with you, they want to keep in touch with the brand, you know, let people know the site, any way to, you know, keep in contact with you and with the company.
Yeah. So pontofootwear.com. In terms of, I haven't talked a lot about the shoes we make, but in terms of really what we look to address is obviously we live in a more fast pace, can do more in a single day than ever before because of technology, ease of travel, et cetera. And so our products really are meant to enable you to do more with less. That sounds trite, but really what that looks like in footwear is not having to trade off or bring a separate pair of shoes for stylish occasions, needs around comfort, things that are durable in terms of like being able to handle different weather patterns or, you know, non-slip situations. So it's like the things that matter to you most, but never at the expense of the planet. So it's not having to trade off style, comfort, durability, and sustainability. And so yeah, we have a lot of new product coming out this year. We just launched some new product with the women's market, I believe last week. And yeah, our shoes, I mean, our loyalty rates from our customers, I think speak for themselves just in terms of how much of the total addressable shoe shelf, as I say, you can actually take on with a pair of Pontos. And if you use the code PONTO20 on our site, it should give you a discount. So yeah, highly recommend. You can learn all sorts of stuff around how long the cushioning lasts in your standard pair of running shoes versus Ponto Pontos, which are far more comfortable and last for over 1,000 miles of walking, and without cushioning degradation versus your standard pair of shoes that last like 150 miles. So I'll save you of the nerding out on feature by feature why our shoes are better. Yeah, experience it if you'll use them and need them. So yeah,
awesome.
Thanks.
Awesome, man. And thank you so much for coming on, Aaron. Really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.